CosmicRadio.tv. This podcast would be nothing without our patrons, so special thanks goes out to them. Want to join their ranks and support independent content? Head to our Patreon at patreon.com/8bitlife. Welcome to a fine edition of my so-called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas. Joining me today, one of the guys working on the video game Tonight We Riot, and of course, member of Pixel Pushers Union 512, Ted Anderson.
Hey guys, how's it going?
That must be like one of the coolest names I've ever said for any like dev team or anything. Pixel Pushers Union 512. I don't know why that this like it has like this like weird, like I imagine like we have like just a, you know, like just a steel worker with like a giant hammer as he's like hitting against like the most pixelated thing ever. Like he's just like, and there's a man like pushing like a giant sprite and you know just into the image. It's like, you know, like tonight we work. Like I see like a Diego Rivera, you know, Rivera kind of mural of all this stuff, except it's pixel art.
Hand-forged pixels, one at a time.
This is kind of funny because we got introduced through a mutual friend, Phil, of a couple of developer friend, who will be on the show eventually talking about some awesome games and stuff, but so he ended up going, hey, like, because we're eventually going to book him, and he kind of sent out saying that something had happened and sort of gave me a suggestion for guests. Like, yeah, I know this guy named Ted Anderson. He's working on this game called Tonight We Riot. So he sent me this link, and I watched the YouTube video for the, I guess it's the premiere thing. It's coming out in 2017 sometime. Yeah. And I hear a very familiar voice, and I couldn't even remember the actor because I was like, this sounds like Adam Jensen. This can't be Adam Jensen. This has to be like a sound-alike, because surely that man is in high demand, you know, working on big AAA games. Surely there's no – not in a bad way, but just like, why would he be talking an indie game? And, you know, lo and behold, check the actor name. Just like, oh, shit, it is Adam Jensen.
Yeah.
Let's just kind of, you know, break the ice a bit. How – because you told me during the pre-show that it's an interesting story how you got him to voice it. And I should look up the actor's name, because I feel like a complete asshole not saying his name.
Elias Tuafek?
Something like that, yeah. It's something along those lines, and I'll look it up because it's one of those names I want to make sure I get. It is Elias. Oh man, I'll never pronounce his last name. Tuface. It's something like that. It's French, and I'm terrible pronouncing names. Anyways, story time.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's. It was kind of weird because, like, initially, we didn't want to have a voiceover for the motion comic at the beginning of it, and you know, through talking with the publisher, he thought that, you know, doing a voiceover work for that would really help, you know, punch it up, make it feel a little more exciting. And yeah, I was initially kind of like, I want to just get this thing out the door, get back to production. Let's just, you know, stop this. And, you know, move on. And lucky for me, he was a little more stubborn. So our publisher contact, he just all of a sudden one night, I'm checking, you know, our Slack channel, and I got this message from him saying, hey, what do you think about having, you know, the voice actor, you know, Elias, you know, Tuafe, you know, do some work on this? And I was like, yeah, sure, that'd be great. Okay, well, but I'm also trying to make sure that we actually get money from this game somehow. So, you know, how much is that going to cost us? And he's like, well, we haven't gotten to that point. I'm like, you're already talking to him? And I was like, oh, I mean, okay, yeah, go for it. And he was just like, you know, nothing's settled right now. I don't know if he's got time to do it and this, that, and the other. And so I just kind of like, you know, threw that on the back burner and went back to making artwork and, you know, talking with the team, getting things done. And another night, you know, rolls by a little while later, and lo and behold, Elias is on board. And I never would have believed it for a minute, but then all of a sudden we've got like voice samples coming over and holy crap, there's this guy who like everyone knows the voice of reading a script that I wrote. And that just blew my mind. So,
well, I mean, like if there's ever, yeah. You know, and again, for those who have no idea who the guy is and who Adam Jensen is, he is actually the lead character for the latest cycle of Deus Ex games. And Deus Ex, of course, is one of the quintessential cyberpunk games set in its own urban dystopia. Like, if there's ever a voice actor perfect for your, you know, sort of the vision of the game, the world that you're building, like, you guys couldn't have casted a better voice actor.
Oh no. I mean, it was a perfect fit. Like, and that's why I was like, initially, like, there's no way this is not going to happen. And it was also one of those things where like, he got all of his stuff done and over to us quite literally right before the voice actors for games went on strike. So it was,
wow.
like literally 2 or 3 days before that. And so that was already rumbling in the weeds that was going to happen. And, you know, my publisher was like, so what are we going to do about that? And I said, you know, of course, you know, we'd be massive hypocrites with a game like this to have this dude crossing a picket line. So I'm not going to have that happen. And, you know, I was like, you know, if we got to wait, we got to wait. But, you know, he knocked it out in time and we're all good. So, you know, it worked out.
Yeah, that strike's going to be really interesting on how it all kind of resolves. Because it's and for those who have no idea what we're talking about, to make a long story short, SAG-AFTRA, the guys that sort of are the union for a lot of voice actors, not just in the video game industry, but also cartoons and a couple of things as well. They also handle actors. They're a big thing. Are sort of in the negotiation for, basically, long story short, we're trying to renegotiate sort of contract deals that have been in place since, and it sounds like almost forever ago, but it was like, you know, it's not that long ago in the grand scheme of things in time, but it's been in place since like the 90s. And to make it very, very shorter, you know, this I'm just basically condensing all this information into like 5 seconds. All the deals kind of fell through, and right now they're on strike, and there's certain projects they can work on, certain projects they can't work on, certain companies they can work for, certain ones they can't, and it all depends on whether they hire union talent or not union talent or all these sort of things. Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine, like, it becomes even harder to navigate as, like, an indie developer, like, how you navigate all those waters.
It is difficult, but, I mean, one of the things we sort of founded Pixel Pushers Union on was that we wanted to make sure that everybody in games was paid for their labor. And because, like, all too often I get, you know, kids run up to me or talk to me at shows and they'll say, like, you know, hey, I'd love to help you out for your game. By the way, I'll work for free, you know, or I'll, you know, do unpaid internship. And I just have to tell them, like, dude, don't give away what you do for a living for free. You know, yeah, someone's going to tell you you're going to get paid in experience or whatever, but experience and money is way better, trust me.
Well, because so, like, we're in a time, and this is what, like, I this is a couple of years ago. It was back when I think it was at one of the South by Southwest, like the gaming conferences, and just like the day before Unreal 4, the engine went free, you know, essentially, and like, just pay us when you can pay us, essentially. And when that happened, I was like, we're in a world where you don't really, like, you can gain experience just doing your own thing. Like, there's nothing that, you know, you can download Unity for free. You can download Unreal Engine for free. You can fuck around in these engines, especially like Unreal being like the AAA engine. You know, like, if you go play a video game, chances are it's using that engine. You can faff around that for free now.
Oh, yeah. No, it's excellent. I mean, I love that kind of stuff. When you have it so that the tools are available for people to learn on, I think that's different. You know, those folks who are putting those products out there, what works out great for them is that eventually those people, if they get, you know, into it enough, they're going to want to go ahead and, you know, try and get into the game industry for real, and they're going to come in trained.
Yep.
And that's great. You know, and they're going to want to use those products. So that works out well for those companies. But, like, you know, for us, you know, on indie dev side, you know, it's, we're working on our own time, and like, no one Pixel Pushers, you know, has a salary yet, though someday that would be very nice.
But I mean, mean, that's sort of the thing. And that, you know, and a lot of people don't, when it comes to talking about these sort of things, there's, you know, when it comes to the game industry, there's so many, especially with this strike going on, there's so many like weird things coming up. Like you hear developers saying things like, and I say publishers, I should say developers. I always mix up, and I should mix up the difference between a publisher and the difference between a developer. But you hear a lot of publishers stating things like, yeah, but the game developers don't get, you know, a certain cut of the profit either. And then the question is, well, why don't they? And then, you know, we start talking about everything. I mean, it's gotten better, but it's this industry that, you know, for a long time, you know, has been around for as long as I've been alive, just because, you know, I don't know a world where video games don't exist. But that's really not a whole heck of a lot of time in the grand scheme of things. You know, like, I'm in my 30s, yeah, and that's 30 years, you know, film's been around for a lot longer than that.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I just, you know, I've been making games since, like, I got into the industry as a professional at 19. And it still blows my mind that, you know, that's 16 years ago for me. And, you know, back then, like, there were no, as far as I know, or at least I never encountered them, no such things as, like, unpaid internships. And, you know, even as an intern, I made a pretty decent salary, and that was nice. It was definitely very helpful. And it was also, like, back then, though, you still got royalties from games. You still got a lot of really good benefits. There was not as much leverage put on, like, contract work and stuff like that. I mean, that stuff still existed, but it wasn't as prevalent.
So let's kind of go back a bit, because I'm actually, and that, it does lead into something I kind of didn't want to talk about, because you mentioned that you got into it 19, and that's actually kind of intriguing. So how did you get, especially at that age, that young age, you know, when most of us are potentially looking at colleges, maybe graduating, you know, high school, you know, just beginning the explorations of our lives. How did you at 19 get into making games, even on an intern level?
Well, first of all, I was a huge nerd, and I still am. But honestly, you know, I was already kind of doing what you were talking about with, like, people who are able to mess around with Unity and Unreal and stuff right now. Man, I wish I had that stuff when I was a kid, because I got started doing mods, and yes, for Quake 2, mods for Half-Life, and man, finding tools back then.
if you want to have a sort of a you know, juxtaposition how it was then versus how it is now, try to find some videos or look up something on, and this is my favorite level editor of all time, and just how terribly crazy it is how they developed it, specifically the Duke Nukem 3D level editor.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Well, because for those who don't know, like, it got to the point of, like, they ran out of keys on the keyboard, so they started using not just the numbers on top, but specifically because the numbers on the number pad give a different key, you know, key binding, give a different, like, sort of scan key. Basically, when you hit it, the computer interprets a different key entirely. Yeah. They use that to do something. And it's, like, the most esoteric, like, weird level editor. And yet people, you know, made not only Duke Nukem 3D the video game, but fans made mod levels and everything else. And I don't understand how.
Oh, what's even great is, like, you're talking about, like, you know, all those keybinds and stuff like that. Half the time when you found this stuff, there were no instructions.
Yep.
Like, you just found it, and you're like, oh, I guess when I press R, it's rotate. Oh, that makes sense. What does Z do? Oh, it closed the editor.
Let me launch this again.
Yeah. But so, yeah, no, that's where I got my start, was working on that stuff. And actually where the actual starting point was buying this really cheap like Photoshop clone in a bargain bin, crappy Sam Goody's knockoff in a mall in Colorado.
What was the name? What was the name? You know the name.
Oh God, what was the name?
It obviously wasn't Corel. It wasn't anything. It wasn't a name product like Corel at the time, because even that was like up there.
The Sam Goody knockoff, and I was like, I can't for the life of me. I know it was probably, that place was probably called, so, like, you know, Samantha Besties or something. I don't know.
It's okay.
But no, the program was called PC Paintbrush. And what was really cool about PC Paintbrush is that the native format for it was .pcx. And a couple folks out there in the world might know, but that was the native image format for Quake 2. So all the textures, all the skins for all the characters were all done in .pcx. And it also had the ability, this is back when we only had 256 colors to use on the texture, you could change the order of where your colors were appearing in that 256 block, which was crucial for Quake 2, because if you wanted to do alpha, it had to be in magenta, and the magenta square had to be in the lower right-hand corner of that square. Otherwise, it would be all sorts of screwed up, and your thing would look like this horrible technicolor, but muddy orange and magenta rainbow. It would be awful. So it was just dumb luck that I stumbled across that and was able to edit this stuff. And after I got done, tinkering around with that, I was like, oh, I wonder if anyone else is doing this, and went online. And sure enough, yeah, people were. Got hooked up in the Quake 2 modding community. There was a game that was called Action Quake 2. And it was a lot of fun. It was really cool. It took the world of Quake 2 and kind of turned it into a John Woo movie, where you're doing all these crazy jumps with, like, pistols and throwing knives and stuff. It was awesome. And, of course, I wanted to be a part of that. It's so darn cool. So I kind of, like, started following the team around online and talking to them and whatnot. And eventually, when Half-Life came out, part of that team ran off and made a little game called Counter-Strike. And I followed along. And I was still a total newbie, but I ended up doing some texture work on a level that ended up in the retail box version of Counter-Strike. It's a big, ugly map. It's not ugly because the level is necessarily ugly. It's ugly because my texture skills were not quite there yet. Called CS-747. It's a big blue and white plane. And that was my first doings as a, quote-unquote,
texture artist. Wow. That's as weird as it sounds, that's kind of a very early, if you think about games, especially like multiplayer games and games that have changed, that kind of define the landscape. Yes, we had multiplayer back then, but not like Counter-Strike, for those who've not heard the name, which I'd be surprised, basically defined what I would say modern multiplayer shooters are. Like, I'd say, like, if all the games, like, that's the one that kind of set the tone of how to approach this kind of format.
Yeah, and it really there was other games, I'm sure, before that tried to do realistic or counter-terror or army focused gameplay, of course, but the gameplay in Counter-Strike, just, man, they nailed it. It's we used to talk about it as being kind of like the chess principle, where it was easy to learn but difficult to master. You could go in there as a newbie, have a blast, play it for hours at a time and become a master at it, and still be having a blast. And that's the perfect thing you want to hit with a game, is that level of fun.
So so Counter-Strike goes retail. Is that what then got you then completely committed to the industry, or was it just like you did this, it got retail, like, oh, that was fun? Like, how did you then translate that into more and more, especially at 19? I'm still wrapping my head around the idea of just at 19 that you're literally working on, it's mods, but it's like it's one of the mods, it's one of the quintessential ones, the one that really pushed a lot of this forward.
Oh, I was even younger at that time. I was probably, when I was doing those types of mod work, I was probably 15-16 years old. And I actually, when the Counter-Strike retail went out, I'd kind of fallen away from PC gaming for a little bit, and I didn't know that my artwork was even in the game. And there were so many people who touched Counter-Strike as a mod that I really wasn't terribly surprised that I wasn't credited. So when I found out it was in retail and my stuff was actually in the game, of course I wanted to get credit for it. And I didn't even want money at that time. I was just stoked that here was my stuff. It's in a professional title. Oh my God, I can't believe it.
It's on a CD. Yeah. Someone took the time to burn this data to a gold master that then got produced as his physical CD. That's how far back Counter-Strike was. I think I still have my Counter-Strike CD somewhere around here too.
But So I went and I contacted Valve, and it took a little bit of doing because I'm sure they were fielding a million different emails from people of, you know, various levels of dubiousness. But I had all the PSD files, you know, Photoshop source files for the art that I'd made. So, you know, proof was in the pudding, and I made a cool $450 off of Counter-Strike.
That's still something, especially at that age, 15, 16. That's a new video game system. That's a couple of game titles to purchase. That's not a, you know, yes, it's not a whole lot of money in the grand scheme of things, but it's for that, for doing that and making what you have said in your mind not the best textures that you did in the planet. That's still a good solid, you know, good chunk of change.
Oh no, it totally is. It's funny to look back on that and how much of a gigantic success Counter-Strike was, and like, you know, the you know, let's be honest, millions of dollars that they were dealing with, and just being like, at the time, of course, I was stoked because I wasn't even looking for money. And then all of a sudden I ended up with like almost half a grand in my lap and was just, you know, happy as can be. But then later on I was like, hey, but you know, I mean, it's just, to me now it's a funny story, but no, actually that ended up working out really well. It ended up kind of propelling me to working on mods even more, because now I was just really excited. Now I had, you know, actual resume with a game title on it. And one night I was talking with my buddies, and we were just kind of shooting the shit with some of the fans of the mod I was working on at the time, called Wasteland Half-Life, which was a Mad Max style mod back in the day. I liked it quite a bit, but we were always a cult classic, never really a bestseller, as it were. But yeah, so there I was. I'm talking with all my buddies, and one of them goes, "Hey, Gearbox Software is hiring interns. You should apply." And I go, "Nah, they'll never hire me. I mean, come on." What? And he's like, "Nah. Send them an email." So I sent him an email with some of the best examples of my work and stuff, and you know that I'd already worked on Counter-Strike, and didn't expect anything from it, you know. But literally the next day, I get an email saying, "Hey, we like what we see. We'd like to give you a call." And oh my God, I damn near jumped 3 feet off the floor. It was probably one of the best days of my life. So I did give him a call, and long story short, I got the job, went out there and just called my mom, told her, I was like, because I was in college at the time. So it was just the beginning of summer. And I said, you know, "Hey, Mom, I'm going to, you know, pay for 3 months worth of rent at my apartment. They're going to put us up in an apartment down in Dallas, Texas. And I'm going to make games for the summer and see if I can't turn this into a real job." And she was like, "Okay, cool." You know, so I just drove from Colorado all the way to Dallas, Texas. And, man, I had a good time. It was probably one of the best times I've had working in game dev, was that intern gig at Gearbox. And at the end of that job, they offered me a full-time gig. And that was fun, though. I got to call my mom up and say, like, you know, "Hey, Mom, I'm dropping out of college to pursue college."
That's what every mother wants to hear. "Mom, yeah. I'm dropping out of college to make video games. What do you think?"
Oh no, there was some nice stony silence on the other end of the phone. But then I was like, no, that's all right. I'm doing my dream job. It's what I wanted to do since I was 13. And you know, here's what I'm getting paid. And we don't have to pay for college anymore. So hey, so then it went over a little bit better. So then after that, I worked at Gearbox, did that for about 2.5 years. And then a little studio called Nerve Software. We worked real closely with id right around the time that they were doing Doom 3. And that was exciting. I still remember seeing normal maps for the first time and like rotating it around back and forth and being like, "Oh my God, it's like double 3D. But, and then after that, worked over at EA Mythic working on Warhammer Online. And That was a lot of fun. Man, that was a really great team we had up there. I'm still in contact with a bunch of those guys today. They're just some of the best artists I've ever worked with, too. Had enough of an East Coast winter, though. Had one of those. I didn't know it could be both humid and freezing at the same time, so I bounced when that game wrapped up. came to Austin and worked at Retro Studios for 5 years, and then moved on to working in mobile games after that, because, you know, it's just a really good growth market. So all the time working on side projects, and, you know, Pixel Pushers kind of just came out of being able to finally work on side projects at the new company I'm at. So
it's interesting because, like, how your path went, because a lot of people always ask, you know, if and I guarantee you probably get asked this all the time, like, how does one get into the game industry? How does one get there? It's like, I want to make video games. How can I make video games? You know, everyone asks those sort of questions. And I've always learned that everybody has an entirely different way of getting there. But all of them kind of start from the basic premise of just doing something. Like, in other words, like in high school, you're just like, you know what? I just want to, you know, let me faff around here in this engine. Let me make a mod or two. Let me just design something. Let me make this texture. Let me just do whatever. And it never starts from this place of like, oh, I'm just going to dream about it. Like, every one of them has like this, like, do something kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing I noticed, like, real quick, was the difference between what I ended up calling idea men and people who actually made mods was like night and day. The idea men would just come and go. There was always somebody who would come in there like, I've got this great idea for a mod. It's like Counter-Strike, only all the levels are in a jungle. And I'd be like, that game already exists, but what are you going to contribute to this? Say I'm on board. What are you going to do? It's like, well, I've got ideas. We've all got ideas, man. Everybody I know who makes games has 100 games they'd love to make. It's what you can bring to the table that allows us to actually make that game.
Well, because that's why, like, a lot of, you know, when people ask, you know, what's the best way to do something, especially in the in-game industry, and even though I'm only tangentially out there in terms of, like, indie press and stuff like that, I know enough of how it works. And a lot of times what developers look for is, have you done something and have you finished it? Because there's you mentioned the idea, man. There are plenty of that. And there's plenty of projects that just like, well, I started it, but I got bored because it got too hard and just gave up. And really what a lot of dev people look at is, did you take a project and did you work it to completion? Even if it's not the best mod on the planet, even if it's rough around the edges, could you take something and complete it? Because a lot of the other stuff in working a team is just sort of learning the mechanics of stuff, learning the engine, learning the language, whatever it is. But if you can take something from idea to complete, that looks way better on a resume than anything else.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And, you know, I was always proud enough of, like, you know, the mod work that I did and, like, the side projects I did, to, like, put that kind of stuff in my portfolio, because, like, you know, that was for me, like, the types of fun projects. Yeah, I'm taking them to completion, but they're not, like, you know, my professional gig stuff. So it's, you know, employers do like to look at that kind of stuff and see, like, okay, hey, this guy's not only making games in his, you know, day job, but, you know, at night he's still got that passion, that idea that he really wants to make art and make interesting worlds. So.
Well, because, like, and even in the game industry, a lot of, you know, like, I always remember, like, certain stories, especially, like, with one of the breakout hits of the past year, is that being, even though Blizzard's a great developer and, you know, known for so many works, before they were known as Blizzard, they were making stuff like Rock and Roll Racing and Lost Vikings. But I always remember when it came to their card game, Hearthstone, that, like, the first time they, like, effed around in Unity to make it a mobile game. And even that was like this, like, side project idea of like, well, can we make a mobile game? Can we do this? And so a lot of those people look at you, you know, look to see not just simply what you've worked on as a commercial project, which is great and excellent, but do you have the ability to pull something out that we haven't thought of yet? Like, is there something in you just like, you know, I have this idea that I've been working on, you know? And that's the difference between, I think, an idea man and somebody that can pull things fruition, because it's that I've been working on, or I am working on, or that is, you know, in this very prototypey state. You know, even a prototype is, you've gotten something working. You've gotten something to a complete point. You know, it may not be a polished game. It may not be balanced. It may not necessarily look the prettiest, but you've faffed around enough to figure out what the rough mechanics are. And that's, again, even something, you know, far grander.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it right there, is that, you know, it really is about, you know, can you bring, like I was saying, like, can you bring something to the table? Are you going to, you know, make your idea a reality, and can you pull that through? So yeah, absolutely.
So let's kind of move on, especially because now we've talked about the past, we've said all the stuff, this we've learned about the Pixel Pushers Union and everything else. Let's, you know, I think it's time we push to the game, specifically the game you guys are working on tonight, We Riot, which we kind of mentioned at the top of the show, and to kind of, if the name doesn't really explain what the game is about, I don't know what else will. You know, it's for long story short, it's basically it looks like kind of a side-scrolling brawling game where I guess the mechanic is to destroy as much as you can for a reason. I guess you go into it. You're far better at the pitch than I am.
I may have given the spiel once or twice at a booth. Now it's what, the easiest way, the elevator pitch for this that I always like to say is it's like Streets of Rage meets Pikmin, and everyone gets Molotov cocktails.
Oh my god, that's the kind of thing you take to a boardroom, and that if the execs are willing, just are like, continue, because if not, at least my exec board would be continue, proceed, because that sounds already eight times amazing. And I mean, the trailer looks great and everything looks fun, but just like the idea of like, what if Pikmin were you know, just had it, just we're tired of life, we're tired of this bullshit.
yeah no, it's totally about that. And so like, you know, the premise of the game is there's no direct hero in the sense of, like, even in Pikmin, you're playing the little space dude whose name I unfortunately can't remember, leading these little Pikmin around, and they're kind of, you know, just following whatever you do because of reasons. Our game, you play a constantly cycling series of heroes, and they're all just, you know, average people. So every time, let me back that a little bit. The core mechanic of our game is that crowd. And you're going to try and build up your crowd and make it bigger and, you know, take the fight to the end of the level. As you do that, you're also going to be, you know, of course, fighting. And every time you you attack in the game, the rest of your crowd does too. So the more people you have, the more effective you are in battle. And there's a couple of different weapons we have that allow you to get a little creative, a little more tactical with how you use your crowd as well. And on top of that, your crowd is your living health bar. So whenever one of your, if your main character dies, you just snap to being another person in your crowd. So suddenly you're a new hero. There's no difference between anyone in the crowd versus your hero, except for that your hero, whenever you're attacking with just melee, with just your fists, you get a cool little combo attack that ends in a Thurukin, that, you know, is really nice and powerful. So nice big uppercut. And, so it's a lot of fun, and it really kind of focuses a game that would otherwise kind of have you doing kind of tried and true crowd mechanics stuff, but pulling in that, you know, that vigorous action of those old brawler games like the arcade cabinet Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Streets of Rage or Double Dragon and all those games we loved when we were kids. It's definitely, we're going for that feel. But on top of that, we really want to make sure that the game, you know, visually pops as well. So, like, you know, our influences are, you know, definitely, you know, Metal Slug is that bar I have set for myself as an artist. Is like, I want to get my pixel art anywhere, even
that's not to say in a bad way, but I mean, you know, it's actually a good way. That's a hard bar to achieve, because and for those who have no idea what the heck we're talking about, Metal Slug is this old video game on the Neo Geo system, which was the pinnacle of video games, 16-bit, because it not only had the arcade cabinets, but you could take the arcade home with you and have these big fucking cartridges that were just literally the arcade boards in cart form, because that was the smartest idea for that system, was to make these, you know, $300, you know, games and systems and somehow sell them. I only had like one friend that had a Neo Geo, and he was pretty loaded.
Well, that, like what am I gonna do, carry $300 worth of game with me to the arcade and then plug quarters into that? And people today complain about, like, you know, payment models on mobile. Crap.
No, rant away, because this is the safe place. In my opinion, this is a safe place for developers to scream at at some of the gaming mainstream audience, because it's like, again, it's so funny when you bring up the mobile bullshit, because I think a lot of people don't quite realize, like, just how not just how expensive, you know, because we talked about this in the Hidden Pre-Show. We could talk about this in the, I kind of wanted to bring it up in the main show anyways, but people don't quite realize, and I still don't understand, if anyone has learned, just how long these things take. Yeah. You know, I think just recently, you know, I mean, a lot of people have sort of, there's been this like weird, I say weird as in like this has been backlash at some indie games. There's like, why are you taking so long to make this game? Why isn't this done yet? I gave, you know, you have like $3 million. You know, why is it you're making this? And it's like, you know, if you ever want a really good article about why games take a lot of time, Rami Ismail, head guy of Lambeer, put on his blog like this, just all the other bullshit developers have to deal with, and they have nothing to do with the game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, go for it.
Yeah. But I was just gonna say, it's also like, I remember being a kid and like, even when I, you know, getting into the like modding scene and not knowing a whole lot about programming myself. And I just thought, you know, hey, some of these concepts seem really simple. Let's just add them. You know, like, just add multiplayer to your game. No. I mean, ideally, yes. But you realize that what you've just asked me is to add, like, 4 months to development. Like, yep. And just the idea of just adding the ability to have multiplayer. That's fine. And that'll take time and that'll take effort. But then we have to rebalance the game for a multiplayer audience. We have to make sure that all the enemies and all the players work inside of a multiplayer, you know, on a server. We have to make sure there's nothing that crashes when it's running in multiplayer, because that's a different environment. You're dealing with, you know, if it's on mobile, you know, it's probably still an issue because there's all sorts of different mobile devices. But, you know, if it's on from PC to PC, man, like finding two PCs that are the same anymore, good luck.
It's not even that. And this is the one thing that always bugs me, especially when it came to Diablo 3, because I know a lot of people complained about like, man, why is this like their servers crashing? They can't handle the load. It's like, that's not even, that's like a portion of the problem that Blizzard can control. We're not even talking about the fact that there are routers and switches and about 80 billion different connection points between you and the Blizzard server. That are not even controlled. That if these servers see a giant spike of load, they think it's a DDoS attack and begin dropping stuff because that's how they're programmed to do defend against DDoS attacks. Because ultimately, you know, those are even elements that you don't even think about as a developer sometimes. Because it's just like, what do you mean I have to worry about this? Like, I had a friend of mine, my friend Richard. He's always on like, because he develops his own games and stuff like that. And he's on like these random like NeoGAF forums or whatnot. And he's always reading these people. It's like, I got a great idea for a new MMO. And it's like, okay, stop right there. Before you go into your game pitch, whatever your idea is, have you thought about server structure yet? What about database implementation? How do you plan to scale this thing? You know, like those are the things that you don't even think about unless you understand that all these things and all these like bigger games, even smaller games, mind you, you know, even like, you know, I had a friend of mine, I got in a little bit of a kerfuffle talking about netcode and how hard that is, that he kept kind of saying like, why, you know, that there's so many things that do it right. Why can't they figure it out? So it's like, netcode is an entirely different thing that becomes this just madness. And if you add multiplayer to that, you know, online multiplayer just becomes just like, well, great, we got to now figure out how to track all this shit on screen and somehow fake it as best we can.
No, you know, absolutely. And it's funny because that you talk about, like, you know, the same thing for like smaller games as well, because when our game first started, I thought this is such a simple idea. We're going to knock this out in like 6 months. No. The first issue we ran into, and I mean, this game has been a bit of an evolution too. Like, initially it started off as, like, I was just doodling in Photoshop, and I made this kind of like mock-up of like a vaguely Marxist Mario Brothers. And we were just kind of like, you know, joking about that as a concept for a game. And then I was like, you know, we could probably make this. And it wouldn't take that long. And then we realized there was limitations to stuff we were doing. Like, we still wanted to get a crowd that 2D playing is really hard to read. So you couldn't tell where your character was. You couldn't really tell where how many people were in your crowd. It was very hard to decipher the action. So we decided to bust that out into 3D. But doing that presented its own problems, because now we're dealing with, you know, 3D space with 2D sprites, and how do we make it read that you can actually walk on top of this car versus, you know, it just opened up.
All right, so we had a bit of a technical glitch, and you know me, I love making jokes about technical glitches because those are like my favorite glitches. And so I'm going to ask you, Ted, game person extraordinaire, what is the best glitch that happened during development of any game you've worked on, or just one, or even if it's recent, if we Tonight We Riot, or just like the glitch you couldn't get that you had happen, and you're just like, how the fuck did that happen? Why the fuck, you know, what's going wrong with this?
Okay, like, right off the bat, I know exactly which one springs to mind. Development. We just switched over to 3D. We're having a real great time with it because, you know, outside of some minor issues, we're learning how to do some really cool new stuff with the game. And one of those is the ability to, like, pick up objects and throw them. So we put in like a road cone and a crate because it's a video game and it needs crates, and a trash can, all this other stuff. And then, like, I can't remember how we got on the topic, but we were like, you know, it'd be kind of cool since this is a city that we do some like pigeons, and you could like run through the pigeons and they'd all fly away, right?
Right.
Well, my programmer at the time cloned the code from like one of the crates and applied the pigeon texture, you know, the animated texture to it. But he didn't remove the ability to pick up the pigeons or up the crate. So if you were fast enough and you ran through the pigeons, you could grab one of the pigeons. And what was neat about that is because the pigeons had the way that, like, you know, stuff works in Unity, they had essentially like negative gravity to them. So they weren't really flying. They were more like kind of floating away. Your character weighed more than the pigeons did, but you'd end up with these like moon jumps as long as you held on to the pigeon. And what was neat too is I don't even know necessarily what kind of like arcane science was going on behind the math on this, but like when you release the pigeon, that thing took off like a bottle rocket. And like, because all the objects in the game had a little tiny hitbox on them, it would like straight up wreck whatever it hit. So like we have like some little flying drones in the game, and you could like there and then unleash the pigeon, and that pigeon would take out that drone in like one hit.
Oh my God.
It was awesome. And so we kept that because you have to.
Oh yeah. Like, no, I was gonna say, like is there a code? Is there a cheat code? Is there something? How do I have moon pigeons from outer space as my weapon of choice as I riot through the streets? Because that sounds amazing. Like every part of that glitch is just like, why did you keep, you know, like tell me at the end of the story you kept this. You at least put the code somewhere hidden. They're just like, well, maybe we'll work this into DLC in the future, because fuck, this is amazing.
Yeah, no, it was really funny because, like, but, you know, we were in a Skype chat, and he was doing a screen share with me, and he's like, okay, I just want to show this to you. And like my first words were like, oh, we're keeping that. And he's like, oh, thank God. I was hoping you would, because this has been like entertaining me for the last half hour.
Of course you keep that. Like, you don't throw that, like that is code you keep. That is, you do not toss that away. That is like, you know, what we call, you know, I think in the words of Bob Ross, that is a happy accident. That is a happy little accident I now want to play this in every game. Why can't we have pigeons that make you, you know, just put that in like in Watch Dogs 2. I don't even care if the game has pigeons or not. I just want, it's like, what's this pigeon object do? Woo, hop on the move. Like, that sounds, that is a glitch of that is serendipity right there. That is a serendipitous glitch.
Wonderfully well. There's been other stuff that's happened in the game, but that one probably takes the cake as far as being like my favorite thing that's happened. Other than that, it's only ever happened once, and it happened right before we were going to appear on main stage at TwitchCon. And so we're getting ready to have our game played live in front of, you know, ever so many people. And so, like, we are nervous because we've been, like, bug checking and bug fixing and trying to get all this stuff fixed up for this issue. And it's, like, the night of. It's, like, maybe an hour till. And I'm playtesting this thing just over and over again. And I get to the boss fight, this mini boss fight we have at the end of the demo level. It's just this mech suit, and it's just giant, and pretty much either tries to grab and squash your dudes or jump and squash your dudes. Well, it jumps, and it squashes me and a whole bunch of my dudes. And then promptly the camera falls through the floor and keeps falling. And I just went, oh, shit. Like, if this had just happened on air, well, I guess no one's going to buy this game. You know, it's just... But we figured it, like, I played it, like, as quickly as I could over and over and over again, trying to duplicate that. It's never happened again. We still totally don't know what happened with that. And I can't repeat it. I don't know what happened, but it just, like, I popped through the floor. I don't know. It was very weird.
Well, I mean, that reminds me of recently. I was doing the extra live stream. I kind of helped participate in that. And one of the games I selected was GTA 5, and, you know, kind of play on PC. And I had encountered a weird glitch where I was in a mission and the character I was playing died. And typically that's more like mission failed and you respawn and try again. But I guess the game hit a state where it knew I died, but it went to its, like, default, if you die in the game, you respawn at a hospital. But it still thought I was in the mission. And so I became in this, like, state that I couldn't even close the game, and I had to actually, like, hard reboot my computer just to actually...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I did, like, and I've, you know, it's that bug where I couldn't reproduce it either. And anyone could, because it just was this weird state of... The game thought I was in a mission, but not in a mission, because I was able to drive around, able to interact with the game. But every time I died, it would still think I was in the mission. So I was like, well, maybe if I die again, you know, put me back, but it could respawn me at the hospital. And I was like, well, let me restart the mission. It's like, you can't restart the mission while you're in a mission. I go, like, I know that. I'm trying, so I kept trying to find the location of where, like, okay, well, here's where the mission was. Here's all the enemies were. They're not there. They're not spawning. Like, the game just went to its weird default state and yet thought I was still in the mission. And I couldn't even exit the game. It wouldn't even let me close because I guess I hit some, like, glitch enough where it crashed out.
Yeah. No, I've totally had that kind of stuff before, too. And that's, like, if anything I've learned in games is that, like, collision is a fickle beast. I remember playing in Warhammer and we were playtesting that. And one of the things we discovered was that if there was ever a collision wall that met at an acute angle, if you wiggled against that hard enough for a long enough period of time, you would pop clean through to the other side. And we discovered that very late in the game. And so that was a lot of last minute running through there and fixing all of our collision boxes to make sure that they had, like, obtuse angles, and just that, you know, a minimum amount of players would try this out. And I'm not sure if we ever fixed everything, but dang it, we tried. there's all sorts of stuff. Like, even like the old Quake 2 days, if you ran along a wall, it would do something with your velocity. It would just end up speeding you up a whole bunch. And what's funny with this is that back in, like, the early Counter-Strike days, because Half-Life code was piggybacked on top of the Quake engine, there was still a ton of old stuff, like, you know, just hanging out in the background. Well, Counter-Strike didn't have jibs, so you couldn't, like, you know, blow someone up and have chunks go everywhere, even if you hit them square in the face with a grenade, right? But if you had enough damage happen to your character, it would still try to call for those jibs. And because it was trying to call for a model that didn't exist, you would crash your game. Not only your game, the whole damn server.
Oh, wow.
So you'd be like 16 other people, and all of a sudden that would drop everyone out of the game. So they patched that in a hurry. But Yeah. So it's, man, it's a tricky thing trying to track down everything that can go wrong in a game because, man, it's pretty much anything. you can't play for, you know, everything to go wrong because, you know, you're going to play it a million times and then suddenly, you know, some kid in, you know, Dubuque, Iowa is going to open it up, jump in the level and be like, well, have you tried this? Nope. And the whole game crashes, you know?
Well, because we're talking, you know, we're talking about earlier at the before we kind of had the glitch happen about just how difficult it is to develop for certain things and PCs and consoles, everything else like that. Even taking the idea of, you know, developing a game for PC, you know, if you think about the entire environment that is PC, no one's PC is alike. You know, there's not just different, you know, video cards, but there's memory layouts, programs running, other things, motherboards, all these kind of things going into it. And any one of those, no matter what engine you're developing on, whether it be Unity, Unreal, whatever, any one of those could adversely affect how an engine interprets something. And even just something that's, you know, just like a memory sector got some other garbage in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And or like one of the things that was confounding us for a long time in our game of Unity was that, like, early on when we first started developing this game, there really wasn't a super strong set of tools for doing 2D like pixel art in the game. But there was a an app called 2D Toolkit, and we were using that, but it had limitations. And then when Unity added its own pixel art kind of 2D support, we switched over because it was doing a lot more than what we were able to do. But man, like, trying to uproot that app from our game has just been like, anytime something goes wrong, like, that's the first place we look now. Is like, are there vestiges of 2D Toolkit hanging out in the background? You know, a bunch of little gremlins pulling on, you know, comically large levers and, you know.
Well, because, I mean, and this is something I'll say, and you can either agree or disagree, but I have a feeling you will agree. You know, people avoid, you know, when it comes to talking about game development, people say, like, I can learn how to program when I learn game development, right? And I'm like, not quite. Yes, you learn how languages work, and yes, you understand the basic premise of certain loops and whatnot, but I've always said the game programming, like, if you look at the source code for any game engine, you're not going to learn anything just because a lot of it is just like baling wire, sheet metal, duct tape, you know, just gum sticking there. Whatever fixed that little patch is just there because it's like, we got to ship this thing someday. And a lot of it is at, you know, at the seat of your pants. And even the idea of just like, you know, like, you'll have people saying like, well, I remember when the hot coffee, the hot coffee thing happened with San Andreas way back when. And, you know, that whole kerfuffle was like, why did you just remove it from the game? It's like, we don't know what that'll destroy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, really, and what's funny for me is that, like, so many, like suburban parents lost their shirts over that, and I was just like, first of all, you have to mod the entire game for that to happen, and let me tell you, spoiler alert, everybody, there are way easier ways to see a lot of porn on the internet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, oh, God, yes.
Yeah, like, so if you're really, like, that hard up to try and find porn, you're going to be like, I'm going to download a mod. It allows me to play a stupid mini game just so I can see some, like, you know, 3D conical boobies. Wow. Like, that's the least of your issues.
It was such a ridiculous thing. Cause I remember, like, what's funny is, like, one of my memories and why I knew about, like, why that was the way it was one of my all time favorite cheats. Cause I'm, you know, I may be a game player, but I always love looking behind the scenes of places where I'm not supposed to be. One of my all time favorite cheats, was for Final Fantasy VII. There was a way you could, set your, like, action replay, whatever game, you know, Game Shark, whatever you're using, to access this, like, hidden developer's room where you could, like, you know, add Sephiroth to your team and go to different sections of the game. And it's such a fun thing to do because it's like, this is what they use to debug the game. And while, you know, as a fan of that game, it's like, oh, cool. I can mess around with this game. I can add every material here. I can add junk material that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's great. Man, one of the things that stands out in my memory of that is, like, way back in the day of, like, Blockbuster Video and me playing, you know, games on SNES and Genesis, there was a Jurassic Park for the Genesis and I rented it. And this is back in the days of, like, you know, proper game manuals and everything. So I'm flipping through there, and there's a little section telling you how to use the password system to access different levels, since there was no save game stasis for that game. But I noticed that there was a code already put in on the screenshot that they had supplied in the manual. I was like, I wonder what happens when I put that code in. It turns out it was basically debug mode.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I urge any of you, if you can somehow find, like, finding the game is probably not going to be that hard. I mean, you check your own, your neighborhood retro gaming store. But, if you can find a copy of the manual or a picture online, that was a lot of fun. That was really cool. So I was playing as, like, this weird warped color version of the Dr. Alan Grant character in there. But I was able to spawn, like, the little green lizards, the little Compsognathids, and essentially, like, I was both Grant and, I think if I remember correctly, it was like your character was both Grant and the raptor character that you could play in the game, so you had different attributes of both, and it was really weird, but it was a lot of fun. So, like, anytime since then, if I run across, like, you know, a password or something like that, like, in a screenshot, I'm like, you know, having made screenshots for games before, the person making this might not have been thinking about it when they were making the screenshot. This might be something interesting.
And even if they were, like that's always, like, half the fun sometimes I think of video games is, like, how you hide those little Easter eggs, especially with those sort of things. Because if you're, like, one of the other ones I always remember when it comes to it is this Squaresoft RPG, or Square Enix now. It's everyone knows it, Chrono Trigger. But one of the endings, it was a new game plus, and you beat Lavos, like, right at the get go, which was a very difficult battle, mind you, because you're literally playing it with, like, you and at the most Marl, and you better hope to God that you can, you know, to also they ramp up the difficulty also at the same time. But if you beat it, then you end up getting in this, like, weird developer room where all the characters and sprites are there, but they're all developers, and you're actually able to talk with them and translate them. It's bizarre as hell. But it's, like, one of my all-time favorite endings because of that. Because I always love those Easter eggs. Like, even in Earthbound, there's a cafe that you can't walk into that's, like, Ape Software working on Earthbound 2. And even though, you know, that never really came the way it came. But I always find that very, very fascinating. And I think we're now entering the era of game development where – I think a lot, like, there's an audience now that wants to know how this stuff is made and wants to see behind the scenes stuff. That's why like BioShock Remastered has, you know, all this behind the scenes footage on there now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny too, because I never underestimate the players for games either. Like, that, you know, if you think that they won't figure something out, oh no, they will totally figure that thing out. Especially, like, you know, I've had it where actually fairly recently, I do mobile development, right? And so this game I'm working on, I had to do some, like, gibberish runes on this stone tablet. And so I downloaded, like, a Nordic rune font, not thinking that it was actually something you could translate or, like, have, like, a direct letter-to-letter, you know, thing to. And I just, like, wrote, like, the lyrics to a song I was listening to just to fill the space. And on the forums, somebody translated it. And at first, like, I was like, oh, shit. Like, I hope we don't, like, have to do, like, you know, a cease and desist order or anything like that. But no, my boss was cool with it. It never really went anywhere. But it was still, like, one of those things where I was like, I thought this was a gibberish font. This was not a gibberish font.
No, there is. Honestly, if we've learned anything over time, you know, and this is from a person that's, you know, came from the era of people, you know, of ROM hacking, of that early, you know, when emulation was beginning, and kind of, you know, how I got into sort of my understanding of how games worked. Because, you know, I played video games, played a lot of SNES, NES games as a kid, but then you get older and you start to wonder, like, how these things are made. And you know, when you learn about ROM hacking, you start to learn how your old school games are made, and you start to have a vaster appreciation of how, like, even as an adult, I look back and saying, I can't believe you pulled that off in Metroid. I don't understand how you figured out how to fit all that into memory. Oh, you reused levels? That's even more insane. And yet you still made it not look that way. That's crazy talk. Everyone will figure out those things. It's like for me, it's my way. I got, and at least as a viewer, because I remember when it came to, like, I think the last game that I got really deep into the community for was Fez, And like even that game hid some stuff in the soundtrack. Like if you took the audio and put it in like a spectral analysis, you saw like QR codes and like numbers and stuff like that.
Oh, that's wild. I mean, like we don't really have anything like that in our game, especially. But you
have a pigeon. You have a pigeon. You have a pigeon I don't think you need anything. I think pigeon, you know, that gives you zero, gives you moon boots and destroys the world. Like I think that's all you need. If it, you know, if every game had a pigeon that did that, I think we would be fine I think we wouldn't have any problems in the world anymore.
Yeah, you know, I think that everyone could use a pigeon that would allow them to float. That would be a really nice pet to have. You know, I mean, it would be an improvement on existing pigeons, I think.
It's pigeon.
Not North Melbourne. How would you say that? But I mean, I think the only other thing that, like, kind of, like, might be interesting to your listeners, too, is, like, the palette for our game. Like, we tried to stay really, really true to, like, old-school pixel art and, like, use very few colors. Kind of as a challenge to myself as an artist, but also just to make sure that the world didn't feel too modern as far as games having like a million billion colors. But the colors, all the colors in the entire game come directly from a piece of Sid Mead concept art from Blade Runner.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So like really like we were shooting for a dystopian world. And I mean, that's one of my favorite movies. That was, you know, a lot of like the visual cues for how this world was going to look kind of started with that as its, you know, spawn point, if you will.
There are two movies in my head that have defined where I think, you know, that like if you ask me, like, what is cyberpunk and that genre? The two movies that defined that as a kid for me and have, you know, continually defined it even as I watch new things and play new things. One of them is Blade Runner, and the other is Ghost in the Shell. Like those are the two, like, quintessential, you know, this is cyberpunk, this is a dystopia, this is the gritty cityscape that I love, and it's both those games and for both those movies and for vastly different reasons, but they're, you know, very similar in structure and in tone, definitely in their urban landscapes. But it's cool you bring up that, because even the soundtrack is, like... brings kind of that synthy vibe to it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that was one of the things we really wanted to go for, was capturing that old school feel for games, but not going directly straight to just straight up chiptunes, but do something that's maybe a little richer that could really drive the feelings of the game, the emotions of what you're doing in the game. One of the things we wanted to do really early on was that when you're playing the game normally, you're not in the middle of a fight, the music is one way. You know, it's just, it's a little more downbeat, it's a little more casual. But as you get into a fight, like it raises up through the track, this alternate version of that track that has like a much more like hardcore kind of like, you know, rock vibe to it. So it's really cool because you can definitely feel that whenever you're playing the game and all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, you know,
it's on.
Yeah, it's totally on. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. We did some interesting stuff with that, and that was our audio guy, who his online persona is 666, spelled SIXIXIX. And if you check him out on SoundCloud under that name, you can check out a whole bunch of cool new music we've got for the game out there and preview it, and it's pretty excellent.
Yeah, so. It's just this amazing kind of synth wave. Like yes, it's dripping with 80s in terms of style and stuff like that, but it's like there are certain soundtracks that are perfect for dystopian, like, you know, like we talk about Blade Runner and that soundtrack, you know, that's synth heavy, but it's such a, like, it's one of those soundtracks I will go back to and just listen, just because it's such a, like, one of my favorite tracks of that thing is like called Blade Runner Blues or something like that, and it's just a beautifully, you know,
it's absolutely wonderful track on there. But
I think we've definitely hit the hour mark. Even with our glitch and everything else, we've definitely. But as kind of a last thing, I guess I gotta ask, because this is something, you know, even though we say games take time and things take a while and who knows and stuff, how long do we have to wait till we get this game in our hands? Because I'm not going to lie. I saw the trailer and I didn't get a chance to, you know, be at PAX or anything like that to watch it. But I really, 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 really want to play this game already, because it looks like it's right up my alley as a just an interesting experience.
Pretty soon, you know, speaking of PAX, we're going to be at PAX South. Check us out at the New Blood Interactive booth. We'll definitely be there, especially because it's fairly local to us. So, you know, me and the crew are just going to jump on down there and hang out. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a lot of really cool stuff that's not even in the trailer for y'all to check out. Our goal at that show is to have three full levels of the game working and a boss fight that was only previewed to a couple people at PAX West, but has been polished up since. And that's right there. Like, that's a quarter of the game. We're going to have four full worlds, each one with three unique levels and a boss fight each. And there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff thrown in on top of that. We really want to make it so that we can just kind of pin on DLC or new levels, new content as we want to and as we will. So, you know, if the game takes off and people really like it and we, you know, see that there's some interest in it, then, you know, definitely we're going to put out some new content for that. And it's just going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I hope so, because it looks like a, you know, as, you know, as games go, and we talk about this in the Hidden Pre-Show kind of thing, but just, you know, when it comes to these sort of things, you know, you know, this isn't the only game that has a dystopian world. This isn't the only game that kind of, you know, takes that. Not in a bad way, just, you know, there's a lot of those. But we talk about this in the Hidden Pre-Show, and patrons will hear about it, but the idea of doing something but asking why. And even that trailer gives us, you know, this, here is the world we're entering. Here is who our forces are. And I love the idea of here's your hero. Here is your actual group of heroes. If one of them dies, congratulations, you're now this guy, because he's just, you're just part of your player, if you will, is the mob. And I love the idea of that being, you know, your character, this just giant swarm of people just like that who have had it. And, you know, tonight we take down the, you know, the forces of evil and, you know, and I love the aesthetic of it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and like the messaging has always been really super important for us as well. So, you know, we just, especially with the trailer, you know, we wanted to make sure that when we put it out there and that when people checked it out, that it was something that was very, you know, in your face about what it was, but it didn't pull any punches either. So, yeah, I mean, definitely I hope that, you know, your listeners get out there and check out the trailer too. I mean, not only is it and lots of fun, got some good music in it, but you also get to hear Elias, you know, doing his thing.
And like I said at the beginning, like, that's like, you could not ask for a better, you know, guy for trailer, because I literally was like, wait a minute, hold on a second. You know, I had to check, because it just was like, this can't be, yeah. You know, how do you get this kind of cast, this perfect casting after all, you know, like, there's no narrator, just like, that's like up there with, like, you know, there's certain, like, times you're like, oh, that's a great narrator, like with the recent, you know, call, I think it's a Call of Duty where they, or one of them where they did the 80s kind of thing, and then they had Hasselhoff in there. I was like, you know, who did you, you know, how did you figure this out? Like, and again, yes, it's Hasselhoff and it's perfect. It's like, that's perfect casting. And just like, this is one of those times in indie games, which is like, that is, there's no better voice actor for this.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And whenever we first heard like the samples that he sent us, like, you know, it was just arms, the hairs on my arm stood up. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be amazing.
Ted.
Let me hit it on it before we actually got this out there. And I was just like, I want to share this with the world.
I know that feeling. Ted, thank you so much for being on the show. Well, if people want to actually check out the trailer and follow the not just your work, but just the work of the game, where can people go?
If you want to check out the trailer, look up New Blood Interactive on YouTube, their channel. You're going to be able to find it there. If you want to follow stuff about the game, we are on Twitter, and that's probably the best place to get the latest screenshots, work in progress stuff, music from the game, trailers that we're going to be putting out. And you can follow us at Tonight We Riot or at PPU512. And either one of those is a really good Twitter to follow. We're also on Facebook. Again, just look up Tonight We Riot or Pixel Pushers Union 512.
There you go. And of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404. They're the Twitters. If you want to catch previous episodes of the podcast, you can go to our website, cosmicray.tv/8bitlife. There you'll find links to the show notes, our Twitter account, which is at 8bitlife podcast. And after you spent all the monies on pre-ordering Tonight We Riot or however you want to do it, after you've done everything you've done to give money, that when you have, like, you know, you look at your pocket, like, I got $3 left, head over to patreon.com/8bitlife and help this podcast become bigger, better, and more awesomer. So that's it for today. Until next time, I talk to another geek about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people. This has been a CosmicRadio.tv audio production. For more awesome shows, head on over to our website, CosmicRadio.tv.